The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The worldwide debate over free expression only grew yesterday when the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo released another issue, barely a week after 12 of its employees were murdered by Islamic extremists. And yes, this issue includes a depiction of the Prophet Muhammad, which is said to have inflamed the anger of those who struck last week. The attack on the magazine in Paris has reverberated in so many ways, from security threats to political fallout to a huge conversation swirling with terms like free speech, the right to offend, editorial judgment, common sense, satire, journalism, and who gets to decide. It's a conversation we pick up on today in The Exchange. What we mean by free expression, what the limits there are or should be, and why some in this debate feel many of those displaying I Am Charlie signs are hypocrites. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests with us. David Folkenflik joins us from New York City. He's NPR's media correspondent. And David, we sure appreciate you taking time out. Thank you.
Delighted.
Also with us, Robert Ozzie, former fellow at Harvard University's Nieman Foundation. Robert's a columnist and photojournalist living in Exeter, New Hampshire. Robert, thank you for being here. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Also with us from Florida, Roy Peter Clark, senior scholar at the Poynter Institute, a nonprofit school for journalism. And Roy Peter Clark, great to have you, too. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Well, and David, I want to start with you with the second release of another magazine with another Prophet Muhammad cartoon. How are news organizations in this country dealing with the decision to publish or not to publish?
To reproduce those cartoons, it's been at the heart of a lot of very intense conversations that have been taking place in major newsrooms all over the country. And you've seen a bit of a split. You've seen news organizations like NBC, CNN, NPR, The New York Times decide not to reproduce the cover. The cover contains once again an image of the Prophet Muhammad in and of itself, seen by many Muslims to be a verboten, blaspheming thing to do, very transgressive and provocative. And that's when you don't even take into account the fact that many people who have seen the cover, as I have, argue that it appears as though there are male genitalia embedded in the caricature of the Prophet, you know, an even more transgressive and provocative act. And then there are others, the Washington Post, which in its news coverage did not include the cartoons last week after the killings, did decide that it was newsworthy this week, and a number of other publications have as well. I want to say a couple things, which is that there's a split between, I think, last week, those who wanted to reproduce the cartoons of Charlie Hebdo, particularly the ones taking on Islam and depicting the Prophet Muhammad as a signal of defiance to the killers, to show that those who would try to silence speech, even transgressive speech, would not ultimately succeed, and those journalists who felt that it was necessary to reproduce the images in order to convey to their audience and their readers and their viewers precisely what the debate was about. And I want to say NPR decided against it. I don't take part in those decisions, and I don't speak for NPR. As a media critic, I disagree with NPR's decision. I think that one can contextualize it and present selected images in such a way that you treat your audience as grown-ups. But I understand those who decide that it's objectionable, that certainly it wouldn't be something that the Concord Monitor would decide on its own to publish. And I recognize the fact that since we have the Internet, those images are widely available with a click. So it's not it's not as though this conversation is taking place in the 1970s and you have no way to get that information if it's not on the three big networks or your local paper.
Well, it's interesting, David, you talk about the split. We put on our Facebook page here in The Exchange NPR's decision against posting the cartoons. And I just want to give everybody a flavor of what our Facebook followers said. Clay says it's a free speech issue. It's NPR's choice. As long as the government is not involved, I'm fine with it. Brian said no, cowardly and undemocratic. Case said show the pictures. Eric said you have the right to decide what you publish and what you do not publish. Christina said doesn't that just give in to the attackers' demands? If you don't show the images, they win. Is that really what we want them to think, that their violence was justified and the rest of us just have to follow their rules whether we agree with them or not? John said fear wins. Candace said cowards. Freda said, regarding these cartoons, to quote a very wise friend, stoking xenophobia is in no way funny. So there we have it, David. You know, this split among our Facebook followers just here on The Exchange, trying to figure this thing out. When people talk about free speech, though, David, and then I want to bring our other guests in, is this really free speech or is this more free expression? What do you think?
Well, I think it's sort of in the same stew and basket of issues. I mean, you think of France as, and France likes to think of itself as in some ways, a child of the Enlightenment of the 18th century. And, you know, freedom of expression is embraced as a principle there, liberté, you know, part of their three-part slogan for the country. And there's a strong also a secular sense of society there. That is that they really worked hard to stamp out religion in the public space there through the revolution and in periods of tumult since. And there's, you know, this real tension with those Muslims and particularly immigrants who are strong, who strongly express their faith in a public space. And so you've got all these different kinds of expression of personal belief. I actually think your commenters on the Facebook page have created a fairly sophisticated representation of the arguments and debates that goes on. I don't think it's entirely fair at all to say that those news organizations that don't do it are cowardly. Many of them that are doing it, for example, like The Daily Beast and Slate and others, are ones without much of a international reporting core. You know, CNN and NPR and The New York Times and others like it that have decided against it, many of those news organizations are ones which have journalists who are the opposite of cowardly, who are in combat situations, who risk their lives all the time, and whose translators and fixers and assistants and producers also do so. And they're in areas often where these issues are take on a life and death aspect to it. You know, you've seen journalists become victims and targets from ISIS and other folks in conflict zones. So the idea that news organizations are cowardly because they choose to take into account whether reproducing the cartoons, you know, is the what they want to be the locus of where they take their greatest risks seems to me to be unfair to the spirit of what they do. That said, as I've said before, I happen to think it's worthwhile in an adult, careful, and contextualized way reproducing issues. Perhaps, you know, online you could have a screen that says, you know, please understand these issues are offensive and click to assent. You know, but there are ways to do this that I think treat your viewers and audience as adults.
Well, and we definitely feel those threats to journalists abroad very sharply here in New Hampshire. As you know, David, we've had two journalists with New Hampshire ties beheaded by ISIS. So that really cuts close here in the Granite State. So I appreciate what you're saying. Robert Ozzie, you've written about this, condemning in the strongest language these attacks. But when people frame this as free expression versus fundamentalist Islam, what's your reaction?
Well, I think they're wrong, actually. First of all, I think the idea that Charlie Hebdo was, you know, an equal opportunity offender is wrong. It, for example, there are laws in France where you can't speak out against the Holocaust. One of the founding editors of Charlie Hebdo, Maurice Sinet, was fired from Charlie Hebdo because he published a satirical column about Jean Sarkozy, the son of the president, where he made what were allegedly anti-Semitic comments. So basically, when you offend privilege, you have some power, you know, and the people who are offended can reciprocate. But when you offend people that have no power, then I think there's a, you know, a lack of equilibrium or equality in that. And I think that we also forget that this is not as much about Islam as much as it is about power and politics. And most of what we see in Islam, in this political sense, is the fact that it basically stems since 1979. In 1977, I was in Paris, and I was printing my first book at a place called Dreger, which is a great printer in France. And they were publishing at the same time a book called The Miraculous Journey of Muhammad. It was a manuscript that is still in the Bibliothèque Nationale, which is the journey of Muhammad ascending to the heavens, in which on every page of illustration, the prophet is pictured.
Really? Wow.
And we were at the press, and there was no security. There were no concerns. There was no sense that somehow we're going to offend someone, because they were doing it in a respectful way. It was, and this manuscript is still at the Bibliothèque Nationale, and you can still see it there, as there are in places throughout the Middle East where you can find images of Muhammad. The question is, in 1979, everything changed, both in Iran with the revolution of Khomeini and in Saudi Arabia when a group of sort of unreconstructed Wahhabis tried to take over the mosque. And at that point, it became about power in politics and much less about religion.
Well, and that's my question, I guess, is, you know, is this really about free expression, or is this about angry people with guns who are going to lash out?
Right. Angry people with guns who are going to lash out basically to fulfill a political agenda.
David Folkenflik, I know you have to leave us, and I did want to just get one last thought from you before you go. Some have said news organizations have a responsibility to use common sense. I wonder what you mean by that, what you think that means, and how you feel about it.
Well, you know, I mean, partly it's allowing news organizations to make decisions not on ironclad rules, but on some combination of journalistic principle and gut instinct in the moment, which is how most news editors, if they're being totally honest after a drink or two, will tell you they do it. And Roy probably has some good thoughts on that as well. You know, one of the things to think about with France, of course, is that the shadow that history casts over Europe, you know, there is, of course, the great shame and record of the Holocaust and of the Nazi era there. And therefore, you know, while they talk about the importance of freedom of speech, you know, the European countries also have certain codes about hate speech there that in this country we debated and talked about on college campuses a couple decades ago, you know, when I was covering higher education, but have decided against, essentially. And so, you know, freedom of expression is something that is asserted and yet negotiated all the time. The freedom to decide what to publish for Charlie Hebdo is the same as the freedom for the Washington Post or the New York Times to decide what to publish. And they shouldn't be compelled to do it. You know, one interesting facet of this is if you feel it's mandatory for a news organization to publish this, every time Rush Limbaugh says something offensive, every time Michael Moore says something offensive, every time somebody is offended, you know, then you would almost think the news coverage would have to reproduce it, and you'd be
David,
turning
gotta
over
let you go.
Your expression
yeah.
force.
Thank you so much for being with us.
There.
Thank you, David. Appreciate it. We'll be back in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the future of free expression. Last week's violence in France, linked to depictions of the Prophet Muhammad in a French satirical magazine, has sparked a global conversation about speech, satire, art, free expression, what the limits are, whether there should be any limits. We're picking up on this discussion as it's unfolding in this country, and we'd like to hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Robert Ozzie is with us in studio, former fellow at Harvard University's Nieman Foundation, a columnist, photojournalist, living in Exeter, New Hampshire. Roy Peter Clark joins us by phone. He's a senior scholar at the Poynter Institute, a nonprofit school for journalism in Florida. And with us now from Boston is Dan Kennedy, associate professor of journalism at Northeastern University. Since 1998, Dan's been writing an annual roundup of New England outrages against free speech called the Muzzle Awards. And Dan Kennedy, welcome to The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, and Roy Peter Clark, I did want to go to you, too, on some of these big themes that we hashed out in the first segment of the show with David Folkenflik and Robert Ozzie. Getting to this idea, please, Roy, of common sense. You know, some people have said, yes, there's free speech, but journalists also need to use common sense. How do you interpret that, Roy?
So, you know, Laura, I think that that many of the comments that have been made on social media and in response to the decisions of news organizations have been very thoughtful, but some of them have been, shallow. And I would say that anyone who says that the decision to publish or not publish one of these images of Muhammad is a no-brainer, sort of has no brains. And all the testimony about how these decisions are being made suggest editors working hard, not by themselves, but in collaboration with many others, to balance certain values. And I think that's my definition of sort of ethics. Morality, in my mind, is a kind of a sharp distinction between right and wrong, the thing that you learn in kindergarten. But what ethics does, along with a good set of standards and practices, it helps you choose. Very often there are two good things that you want to accomplish, or you have to choose choose the lesser of two evils, and that's where ethics comes in. I've been thinking about changing, thinking about these decisions in terms of other stories that the press might cover. So let's take something like child pornography, which we know is a terrible crime. And that it's sort of international and enabled by the internet. I don't think there's any journalist who would publish in a news organization or online an image of child pornography in order to sort of call attention to this terrible crime. The same thing is that I don't remember. I mean. What about images from the war front? What about, think of all of the images that could have been published after 9/11 of the effects of that destruction on human life and how they were concealed from us, not as an act of censorship, but as a kind of, within the sense of the boundaries of good judgment, of consideration for the victims, consideration for the readers and listeners. I think that this decision to publish the cover or not seems to me to be that I have respect for the decision-making process that has been going on, even though that process has led editors to make different decisions.
I want to bring you into this too, Dan Kennedy, and then go to our listeners. So again, if you want to join us, we'd love to hear from you. Email us exchange@nhpr.org. We've got a great conversation going on already on our Facebook page. You can also send us a tweet or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. So Dan, before you joined us, Robert Ozzie was saying, when he hears people frame this as free expression versus fundamentalist Islam, he said it's a lot about politics, too. It's a lot about power. It's a lot about the privileged sort of poking more fun at the underprivileged. What do you think? How much is this about free expression? How much is it about other things?
Well, first of all, I'm racking my brain trying to make sure I haven't used the term no-brainer. I don't want Roy to come after me. I think you make a very good point because certainly this has everything to do with free expression in that we ought to be free to publish and look at offensive material if that's the choice that we want to make. But free expression has a flip side too, and that is, we are free not to publish this stuff, and just as we should not be bullied into not publishing material that some might find offensive, we shouldn't be bullied into publishing it either. Now, I do believe that good news organizations could reasonably come to the decision that they ought to show some of the images from Charlie Hebdo as news, this is what the controversy is all about. But no one's under obligation to put up a gallery of all of the images, for instance, just to show that they are dedicated to free expression. If their standard several weeks ago was that they would not run material like this, then their standard shouldn't change in the wake of this terrible tragedy that's happened.
Let's take some calls, gentlemen. Lots of people who want to jump in, and we've got some emails, too. Thanks for all the comments. The number, 1-800-892-6477. And Greg's in Milford. Hi, Greg. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Yeah, I think that the question's a pretty broad one. You know, looking at all these issues, and it's up to the media to have a certain amount of responsibility, and it's up to the people to have a certain amount of responsibility. I'm a pretty much a freedom of speech absolutist, but I don't think that means that the media is obligated to run pictures of everything that happens. You know, there's a terrible accident with a child that gets killed, and I expect that the media would probably be, you know, in their right and doing the people right by not showing that picture of a kid on the side of the road. There's some media outlets that still like to do that.
So media is always sort of choosing, deciding, Greg, holding back or not holding back.
Sure, I think so. I mean, you know, recently with the New Hampshire journalist that was beheaded, you know, the decision to not run any of the images from ISIS that they produce, is that censoring? I guess you could say it's censoring, but it's also not forwarding an agenda of a pretty toxic bunch of people. And I think that's sometimes the point of propaganda and of images is to actually, you know, push a pretty a negative agenda. And then you come into with the Charlie Hebdo, I think that there's the competing challenges of, you know, talking about power disparities. And in France, I think there's a pretty, you know, significant effort to be, you know, freedom of speech absolutist, but like has been said, that there are restrictions against Holocaust denial. So there's it's not necessarily an easy line for the media to navigate.
What about, Greg, the role of sort of satire and comedy, I mean, outside sort of mainstream media or, you know, newspapers, radio stations and so forth? What about just the people who have said, look, it's the role of the satirist to kind of point out things that need to be pointed out? What do you think of that, Greg?
Yeah, I think it's a very important thing for that type of you know, people to have that ability. There's a clip online of some Kurdish group making fun of ISIS, and it's you know, there are these really, you know, extreme caricatures of guys dancing around singing about, you know, killing all of our people we don't agree with and you know, herding goats or something. And it's very, very funny and silly, but there is that. If a white American guy would have produced that, you would be inclined to say, hey, that's kind of a racist thing. A bunch of Kurdish people fighting against like-minded and like ethnic folks seems to me that satire. So I think that there's that issue that David Chappelle ran into, where he actually felt that he was promoting black stereotypes using some of his humor, and that caused him to freak out and stop doing comedy for a while. Because were people laughing at the actual comedy of what he was doing, or were they laughing at him, you know, buying into the stereotype of what a lot of people think is funny?
Okay. Greg, thank you. I want to get Robert Ozzie on this. Robert, this picks up perfectly on what you said earlier. Partly it matters who's doing the satire.
It matters who's doing the satire, and it also matters how you're presenting the satire. As one of the things I really fault the press on over the last week or so is their lack of context, of being able to present what's happening in Paris or here in this whole discussion without anyone discussing the whole history of what brought these French citizens — they weren't immigrants, they were French citizens — to the point where they thought they needed to act in this way. The 150 years of exploitation of Algeria, the hyper-secularization of France, and it was only a handful of women that were affected, where France banned women being able to veil or use the burqa.
I remember that.
And not having any sense, in fact, even of what depictions of the Prophet mean in Islam and what it means to Muslims. I'm a Muslim. I'm frankly not offended by most of this stuff because I think they're really stupid and sort of crass and ignorant. But I find that they're a deliberate provocation of a people that have no way of responding. They don't have their own magazines. They don't have their own voices. They don't have their own organizations where they can go on and say, we believe in the prophet. We believe in the way that you're showing it is offensive to us. You know, France is the most racist country in Europe. And the Algerian or North African population, their witnesses it on a daily basis. I just want to add a Facebook meme that my daughter sent on to me the other day, and she quoted it as an old white person proverb. It's not racism, it's just satire. You know, and in fact, when we look at it from power, we look at it as satire. And well, when we look at it as a victim, we often see it as racism.
Let me ask you this question, and I want to focus more on reaction in this country, how we think, how we feel. But since you mentioned, you know, the history that has been raised of Muslims in France, some non-Muslim Europeans have sent this message over the past week to Muslims living in Europe in general. If you don't like our customs, if you don't like our traditions, if you're uncomfortable with the way that we talk, speak, so forth, you know, this is our society. This is how we want to live. Go somewhere else. I'm sure you've heard people say that.
Oh, you hear it all the time. We don't hear it as much here in this country because American Muslims are much more assimilated. But these people have nowhere to go. You know, if you're 5 million Algerians, you ended up in France because your country was, you know, millions of Algerians were killed by the French. You ended up because you were looking for opportunity and because that was the closest place where you could find a familiar landing, you went to France. You know, these people are born in France. The killers last week weren't immigrants that sort of came over. They were born. They were educated in the French system. And this is the way they struck out. I do want to mention one other thing, which I think people don't know. In our Supreme Court, there's a frieze above where the justices deliberate that was carved in at the beginning of the lawgivers of the world. We have a depiction of the Prophet Muhammad standing next to Charlemagne in the United States Supreme Court, full face, holding a Quran, holding a sword. He's there with Confucius and Moses and everyone else. And no one takes offense. It's done with respect. It's done with dignity. And it's part of the public square in which Muslims in this country can operate. There's no public square for Muslims in France.
I want to turn to you, to Roy, Peter Clark at Poynter. Again, this idea of, you know, satire, comedy, cartoons, and so forth. What do you think? Doing the satire matters, as Robert is saying.
Yeah, there's a satire has always been dangerous. In sort of writing about this, I was doing a little research, and I was reminded that Socrates was killed in part as a result of the parodies of him and his philosophy by Aristophanes in the play called The Clouds. So it goes back at least that far. If you look at the history of satire, it seems as if satire, to be effective, it has to be licensed by power to a certain extent, even though it speaks against power, right? It's in Shakespeare, it's the character of the fool who can speak truth to King Lear, and who comes up to the line that no one else is able to cross. I think the problem that we're seeing now is that we have a clash of cultures in which the social contract that exists in France can't coexist with a philosophy that may see blasphemy not just as objectionable but as a capital offense. And that's where I think people begin to draw a much stronger line.
I want to read a few emails, gentlemen, and then go back to our callers. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Alan in Durham says, very few in the media are noting the irony that free speech is far more restricted in France and England than here in the U.S. That's from Alan. Here's one from Christopher in Manchester. He says, I was impressed with the notion that David Brooks
put forward in a column after the French attacks. He said that much of the free speech, which the Je suis Charlie folks were marching for in Paris, would be muzzled on a modern-day U.S. college campus. One of you mentioned that earlier in the show, I think. And here's one from Jordan in Auburn. He says, while I support the cause of free speech and this Je suis Charlie movement, I cannot help but wonder if people would have been so quick to defend the speech of, say, the Westboro Baptist Church, had they been the ones massacred by other Christians or atheists. While we agree their speech is hateful, and many, including myself, hate them for it, the Supreme Court has said they have the right to say it where they will. There's some smattering of opinion from our listeners by email. Let's go back to the phones. And Jedediah is joining us from Tilton. Hi, Jedediah. Go ahead.
All right. So more or less what I have observed with this whole issue is satire exists for a reason to draw criticism to something. And if it's offensive, so be it. As long as you're making an informed and educated point, that's fine and well. However, it seems that this only serves to create an anti-Muslim sentiment. If you're going to be in the country of France, where there's extremely secular bias, all you're doing is saying that it's negative, and they're using the guiles of a terrorist attack to say, hey, these people are bad. And vilifying terrorists is about as brave and courageous as saying, you know, Skeletor is the bad guy. Of course, that's something no one's going to agree with. But all you're doing is inflaming and creating a negative environment for Muslims, and that seems incredibly negative. Regardless of freedom of speech, all you're doing is justifying hate speech, and that's a very dangerous path to go down.
What do you think, Robert, real quickly, that this is just inflaming tensions, violence, and don't go there?
I think it inflames tensions, certainly. And I think that there's a responsibility in the Muslim community to deal with the political tensions that exist, for example, with ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Yemen and so on. But I don't care if you go there or not. I care how you go there. I care whether or not you're actually picking on someone simply because you can, or picking on somebody because it's an important issue that you have to make, and this is the only way that you have, or this is the most sophisticated way to do it.
Okay, Jedediah, thank you for that call. Dan Kennedy, I have a question for you after the break as well. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the future of free expression, this whole conversation about what we mean by free expression, what seems allowable, what seems reasonable, what doesn't, whether free speech is shut down when certain news organizations decide not to publish the cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad that seemed to spark violence in France last week. Our phone number here in The Exchange for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Robert Ozzie's with us, former fellow at Harvard University's Nieman Foundation, columnist and photojournalist. Roy Peter Clark is here, senior scholar at the Poynter Institute, a nonprofit school for journalism. And Dan Kennedy, associate professor of journalism at Northeastern University in Boston. And Dan, as I mentioned earlier, for a long time, you've been writing an annual roundup of New England outrages against free speech called the Muzzle Awards. Do those major news organizations who choose not to print these cartoons win a Muzzle Award or not, Dan?
I would say probably not. I don't think it rises to the level of a muzzle. I mean, first of all, we try to focus on actions by the government. I mean, only the government can censor. News organizations edit, and they can choose to. They have every bit as much of a right of a First Amendment right not to run something as they do to run something. So no muzzles.
What about the idea of satire, comedy? I think Roy mentioned, you know, the court jester is often the only one that can speak truth to power. What do you think about that and how people will feel about satire in the future, especially satire when it has to do with these topics of, you know, the Prophet Muhammad and so forth?
Well, I certainly agree with a lot of what your guests are saying. I am pretty much a free speech absolutist. And I think that it's important for all of us to absolutely support Charlie Hebdo's right to run these cartoons. But at the same time, I think that satire that resonates best is satire that mocks those in power. And I think that Robert made a very good point that this is satire that's really mocking people who are already powerless. And I think that that is a crucial distinction that we ought to be looking at here. The other thing is, I think that all of us, including me, have been guilty to some extent of looking at this in an American context and failing to understand some of the differences that we have in Europe. I mean, Robert mentioned France's history of racism. You know, there are laws in European countries against Holocaust denial, for instance, and we would find that abhorrent in the U.S. It's perfectly fine to go around denying the Holocaust if that's what you want to do. But there are very good reasons for why European countries ban Holocaust denial. We can't forget the historical context in which some of these things play out.
Let's take a call from Carol in Londonderry. Hi, Carol. Thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Hi. I'm very happy you're having this discussion. I believe in free speech, but it needs to be defined. It shouldn't be you can say anything at the expense of anyone. You know, freedom of speech to me is freedom to express beliefs and opinions, not freedom to slander and debase someone, even in satire. I think it's terrible that they should humiliate the Muslims, you know, and it's just wrong. How would we feel if they did something like that to Jesus, you know, or to a president? There should be boundaries. That's the way I feel.
Okay,
and
so
I'm glad you're discussing it.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for calling in, Carol. And I think I'll turn to you first, Roy Peter Clark, on that.
Well, you know, it's so interesting to hear that caller, and I think in the United States, you know, how far are you guys up there in Concord from Plymouth Rock?
Oh, I don't know, a couple hours, depending on the traffic.
Well, if you think about it, you know. The European history of the United States begins with a group, an oppressed group that's trying to create a new society in which they can express their religion and their ideas in a new open way. And that's not – that's part – Act One. Act Two is the Salem witch trials. So there's this tremendous tension, I think, in the history, even of the United States, where the boundaries of speech and expression are very wide, between a desire for freedom and a desire to to ask for – responsibility as part of that sort of negotiation. I think most of us who sort of think about the First Amendment and what it does for us is that it would probably, the First Amendment would almost be unnecessary if there weren't such things as crude satire and neo-Nazism and Holocaust denial and a lot of the kind of speech that most people revile. And I think it's fair to say that it's exactly that kind of speech that the First Amendment was designed in a visionary way to protect.
Carol, good to hear from you. And let's go to Conway, where Eric is on the line. Hi, Eric. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. This whole discussion is, we're allowing it to be framed by a few people with guns. I would imagine if people demonstrated out in front of Charles Hebdo for a day or two, we would not even have heard about it in this country. And this gets to the bigger issue of the whole profiteering of the arms trade and how we don't do anything to do that. We just have more arms to try to fight back, and we try to squash any kind of open discussion or expression.
So this is being, the boundaries are being decided by people with guns, and you're not happy with that, obviously, Eric. And he's hung up. But, yeah, go ahead.
The whole discussion is being framed by people with guns.
Okay. Glad you're still there, Eric. And, you know, this is something, Robert Ozzie, that a writer in The Atlantic brought up and reminds me of what Carol said about, okay, I support free speech, but some boundaries. This writer in The Atlantic said, you know, we can't let men with guns tell us what we cannot write or read. So there's Eric's point. I wonder what you think, Robert.
Well, I agree. I mean, I have no problem. You can write whatever you want. You can publish whatever you want. I I actually quite like the new cover of Charlie Hebdo, of The Prophet and the Tear. I actually see in the message of all is forgiven a sort of a double entendre. You know, it's not just speaking to the prophet to Muslims, but I think it's Muslims through the prophet speaking back to Charlie Hebdo and the society that created the situation in which all of this violence erupted. It was the, in effect, I think it was the power of the spirit of the word overcoming the pen being expressed in that illustration. I think men with guns and men with pens have responsibility in how they use them. To a previous caller, I'm not humiliated by what Charlie Hebdo did in these cartoons. You know, it's not a challenge to my faith of power. I think what it is, it's a challenge to the press and to people. How they're going to frame these conflicts between, if you want, civilizations or between the haves and have-nots. It's how do we deal with the wretched of the earth, you know, and how do we empower them to have a voice other than through guns?
What do you think, Dan, this idea of who decides and do we let men with guns decide? But well, then we have other people saying there needs to be some boundaries.
Well, you know, I would argue that fundamentally we don't need to have boundaries. You know, at least in this country, obscenity narrowly defined, genuine threats to national security, and direct incitement to violence are banned speech, but everything else is allowed. And I think that we have staked everything on the idea that the best solution to bad speech is more speech. But as I said, the European context is different, and I don't think it's fair for us to necessarily judge some of the decisions that they've made about why they have a more restrictive view of free speech than we have. But fundamentally and emphatically, once we let people with guns dictate to us what our speech ought to be, we've really lost the whole battle for having a free and open discussion about anything.
Let's take another call. This is Stacy in Rochester. Hi, Stacy. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks so much. I just wanted to make a comment on one of the comments that your guest made, comparing the publicizing this photo akin to publishing an image of child porn, which I think is such a false argument. One is criminal and one is satire, and political and religious figures have been satirized throughout history. Child porn is a completely different issue, and it's wildly inappropriate, I think, to bring that into the conversation. It has nothing to do with the images that were published in Charlie Hebdo. One really hurts and is a crime, and the other is not. It might be offensive, but it's a wildly different thing. Thank you.
Thank you for calling in, Stacy. Roy Peter Clark, what do you think?
Well, I would say that, you know, I just wanted to make a distinction between, let's say, something that has news value that is complicated by the nature of the image or the crime. So even from, you know, going back to World War II and Life magazine, there was a tremendous amount even among the photo editors in Life magazine who had these gruesome images from World War II would put a veil over them in order to, in some sense of sort of decorum and respect. So the point I was making is not that these two things, child pornography and that those images are identical, only that all of us in society recognize that there are some images that should not be published, no matter how absolute, I think, absolutist our embrace of the First Amendment might be.
Here's a couple more emails I want to share with all of you. Ron in Manchester says, I'm tired of people equating criticism of a religion with racism. What you believe and the color of your skin are completely different. He says playing the race card in this context is an effort to cloud the issue and humiliate the criticizers into silence. What someone thinks is true should never be outside the scope of criticism. And then here's one from Cricket, who says, how much do you think the recent manhunt and follow-up security costs? Can their economy support more taunting? Is it selfish to put more citizens at risk? Robert Ozzie, thoughts on both of these from Ron in Manchester or from Cricket? The racism comment, tired of people saying that's racist.
Well, you know, I go back to that old white proverb, you know, it's not racism, it's just satire. The point is that when people are excluded from participation in the public square on the basis of their ethnicity or their religion, it's a form of racism, whether it's in Ferguson or whether it's in the banlieue outside of Paris. And you can try and defend it as free speech and say, I can say what I want, and it's not racism because it's true. But that doesn't diminish the effect of it. And if you are demeaning another person and you're exploiting them for profit, as Charlie Hebdo was doing, then it's a form of racism. You can take on the Catholic Church, as they did, but the Catholic Church has a large constituency in Paris, and they can respond as however they want to. But to take on someone that has no voice is a form of racism. It's a form of the exploitation of the North Africans that, viewed by the point of view of the victims, had started 150 years earlier and was continuing to that day. I don't justify the violence, but if we try and deny that there are those kinds of tensions in those communities is to assure that it's going to happen again in the future.
Well, and that gets to Cricket's point, concern that this new publication will only put possibly more citizens at risk.
And the burden is on our press, as well as the French press or any international press, is that if we fail to contextualize these events in a greater context, then we are, as a press, participating in prolonging these tensions and conflicts between these communities.
So looking at our press, gentlemen, moving forward, what do you think, Dan Kennedy, given what we've seen, you know, just over the past week, what do you think that news outlets, satirists, comedians, the Jon Stewart types who do these, you know, satire shows on television, are people going to be holding back in this country out of fear? Will they be putting forward even more to say, you know, I'm not afraid of you? What do you think?
Well, I don't know that it's going to have any effect in this country. If anything, I think that people may react to the events in France by pushing the envelope a little bit more. You know, Jon Stewart is a fairly benign presence, but I would be curious to know what Bill Maher might have to say, given his demonstrated hostility toward religion in all forms. That would definitely be something to keep an eye on.
He's already said it.
Has he? Okay. Yeah. What do you think, Roy? The future.
You know, I think this. So I'm gonna play the Aristotle card here.
Go for it.
And to really simplify it, Aristotle's notions about sort of justifying actions has to do with the golden mean and a kind of a sort of a middle path. And I want to say something about the Tampa Bay Times, which is the Pulitzer Prize-winning newspaper that the Poynter Institute, my workplace, happens to own. And I opened it up yesterday, and I'm looking now at page 2, which is Nation and the World. And the headline is Reprisals Feared Over Charlie Cover. And there's a photograph of someone holding the new magazine. And then right there in the middle of the column is an image of the cover page of the Prophet Muhammad saying all is forgiven, but it's 1 inch square, and it's not in color, it's in black and white and gray. And I said, that's a news organization that's trying to walk a middle path, so it's treating its readers like adults, but also not using the worst kind of methodologies of hype and sensationalism that could have been used irresponsibly.
Well, Roy, we'll let you have the last word there. Thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Roy Peter
Thank
Clark,
you.
Senior Scholar at Poynter Institute. Dan Kennedy, great to have you too. Dan Kennedy, Associate Professor of Journalism at Northeastern University. And Robert Ozzie, it was good to see you. Thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you.
Robert Ozzie, former fellow at Harvard University's Nieman Foundation, columnist, photojournalist living in Exeter. This is The Exchange on NHPR.